This is the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. This show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. This episode of the Big Web Show is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. Build and manage your email list, design killer HTML email campaigns, and send emails with supreme confidence. Sign up for a free account, and you can store up to 500 subscribers and 3,000 emails a month. MailChimp's new location-based technology also gives you the power to send email campaigns that include things like geotargeting, locally timed delivery, auto-translation, and much more. Visit them at MailChimp.com/5x5 to find out about special deals just for Big Web Show listeners. This is episode number 18 of the Big Web Show. I'm Dan Benjamin. My co-host, as always, is Jeffrey Zeldman. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Dan. How you doing?
Doing well. We got an exciting guest today, and as usual, perhaps you could do the honors.
Yeah, we sure do. Our guest today is Roger Black, and where to begin? Roger's been an art director, a leading art director for decades, like 3.5 decades, maybe a little more than that.
That's
very youthful. Yeah, that's enough. But he designed Rolling Stone, New York Times, Newsweek, New Republic, Fast Company, Advertising Age, Esquire. He was an art director at those magazines. He was, for instance, an art director at Rolling Stone when Hunter S. Thompson was a major contributing writer there, and you could just listen to those stories for hours. He's also the co-founder with David Berlow of the Font Bureau, a big, impressive, leading, incredibly high-quality type foundry, and a founding partner in Danilo Black, an international design agency he co-founded with Eduardo Danilo. He is also, he was a co-founder of one of the largest, the Interactive Bureau, which was one of the huge dot-com web design agencies during that first dot-com era. And it, I think he closed it a week before the bubble burst, something like that. And, you know, that would be enough achievement for most people, but Roger's very prolific. And in the last couple of weeks, he's launched four businesses, or co-launched four businesses. Among them are WebType, which creates high-end fonts for online typography; TreeSaver, which is a platform that uses CSS, HTML, JavaScript, and responsive design to publish beautifully formatted content on any receiving device that has a web browser. He also created or co-created Ready Media, which designs templates for newspaper and magazine publishers, which has not endeared him to some designers. I'm sure we can talk about that. And finally, co-launched Nomad Edition, or is launching Nomad Editions, which is a series of digital weeklies designed directly for mobile devices. So, you know, if you're talking about web content and art direction, you pretty much, and web typography, you pretty much, Roger's name's going to come up no matter what. And, you know, in terms of present and past, is pretty pretty remarkable career. And let's start talking about some of the new things you're doing, Roger.
Great. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I know you've been a quiet but leading force behind the adoption of web type, web fonts. I mean, we were debating what we were going to call these things, or and when I say we, I'm just sort of, I was in the room at the time, that's all. I wasn't really in charge of anything, but web fonts have been coming for, you know, since maybe, you know, in theory they've been coming forever, but you've been really one of the people leading the charge for them, and for their adoption, and for making sure that the quality works across browsers and platforms, which is not particularly easy. So maybe we should start by talking about WebType, WebType generally, and then WebType the company.
Well, thank you. The you're actually much more of the pusher on WebType than I am. The I've been with Font Bureau thinking about it and trying to figure out what could be done. And I think many of us who design websites made some tragic mistakes early on trying to make fonts that weren't designed for text to work on the web, and they didn't work that well. And so with David Berlow and Sam Berlow and Peter Van Blocklin and then the guys from Ascender, we started thinking through what are all the issues, the different browser OS combinations, and the whole thing about the rasterization, that each platform renders fonts differently, and you can't always predict what's going to happen. At least I couldn't. And bit by bit, we kind of analysis and trial and error, we've gone through and tried to tweak the delivery of the fonts for every platform. And that, I think, is the main advantage that we have now in launching WebType, that we actually can pretty much assure, with the vagaries within the boundaries of the client settings, that you can get great fonts on the web, and you can get the ones you want. And more than that, David has now done six new text typefaces that are called reading edge fonts that work very well for body type on websites.
What's the history of those fonts?
Well, the history is fascinating. Font Bureau has a long time connection with Matthew Carter, and Carter designed the fonts for Microsoft primarily Verdana and Georgia. And David was always thinking about screen fonts, having worked on a lot of the OS corsets for Microsoft and Apple and elsewhere. We did the fonts a couple of years ago for the Palm Web OS. We're doing fonts for another big phone OS now. It's an important problem, and trying to get great fonts that work on screens of various resolutions. So Verdana worked great, and he was trying to figure out what it is about Verdana that works so well. And he noticed the similarities between what we called agate fonts, the very small newspaper classified ad fonts from the lead type era. And what it is that it's the drawing. These fonts are very open. There's a there's what you call an open aperture. There's a very, very carefully designed spacing, high X height, and a variety of things have worked together to make small fonts very easy to read. And so he adapted this, not so much worry. Georgia, has the same thing, and Verdana have the same problem. That we have with WebType, which is there, you don't know what the client settings are going to be, or what exact operating system or rendering you're going to get. So you start with a drawing, and that's what David did. And I think the reading edge fonts are fascinating because we've taken one of them is pointer old styles coming up. We have some like antenna that are very current and contemporary fonts that look really great and as text. And then there's the old standby Ionic number 5, which we're calling Benton Modern RE, which is a classical newspaper text face from 100 years ago.
Wow. Where would we find these? Are they up on WebType yet? These cool fonts?
Four of them are there. Yeah. Pointer is not there, but four of them are, and we're trying to bring out several every quarter. We don't really have a fixed schedule, but David has enlisted some of the other Font Bureau designers like Richard Lipton and Cyrus Highsmith to work on them. That's where some of them are coming from, and it's really a design philosophy much more than is a technology philosophy. And
right.
The technology is important too, but it's the design that makes it work.
So this is not a case of you're saying, if you like Franklin, you should try this because it's this is Franklin reset to look good as a body text. Instead, you're saying, here is a font designed for the screen to work well as a body text in the same way that in a different era, Georgia and Verdana were. Here's a font designed to work well on the screen. It doesn't necessarily owe its history to any prior font. Or is that, I'm just making that up. Am I right?
That's almost true. The fact is that the all of these fonts have some predecessors. Antenna which has the current kind of square serif style is not as doesn't have as clear historical roots, but there are some. And the thing is that if you take a look at the Benton Ionic looking font, but Benton Modern RE. It's been around for 150 years, and it's been used for exactly the same small text. So There is some connection, and also we have a thing where we got some actual parallels, so you can use Benton Modern Display to go with your text and so forth.
It's kind of Clarendon-ish.
Yeah.
If I may say.
Yeah, it is. It's Ionic. It's Clarendon and Ionic are really the same thing. It's funny because that was my favorite typeface in 1970. And I'm delighted that it's out there.
Which it's Benton or Clarendon?
No, Ionic. Yeah, the Ionic number 5. You know, the I don't know how far you want to get into this, but the Linotype had something they called the Legibility Series, which were typefaces like Corona that became the most popular fonts for newspapers in the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Monotype had made one called Nimrod that was in the same style, and there was Imperial from Intertype, which is what the New York Times uses. All of that, those fonts came from the 19th century and pretty much were the 20th century newspaper typefaces. All have a distant relationship to century, but they have thicker thins and little stubby serifs, and they print well. At least they used to print well in letterpress. And later, other fonts took over, and it was not... styles change, but the utility of these fonts is still extremely great, good. So we like them.
So if a font in the age of fast, cheap printing, if a font worked well, even at small sizes with, you know, like for a newspaper where you're not really controlling the ink and the paper isn't that good and everything, then it might work well as a screen font as well, just as an example.
You'd have to talk to David about the details of that, but I completely believe that's the case. I think that the visual characteristics of the fonts and the human eyeball, the way we read, are very similar. And so what works in that environment? You know, I've been working on the web now from 16 years or whatever. The thing is that... in the beginning, when I kept saying, hey, let's take the lessons we learned in print and try to apply them here, there are a lot of web designers who thought that was out of my mind, that won't work. And I don't think, you know, obviously many things that people have tried to take from print and shove onto the web don't work. But they're old lessons, the human behavior, the way people read, what people are interested in, those kinds of the kind of bedrock of culture should be applied. And so I think that if there's any way that we can take good typography from the metal days and the letterpress days and use it on the web, let's do it.
Roger, I have a question for you. One of the things, and people in the chat were talking about this a little bit as well, but it occurs to me that, and you mentioned a couple minutes ago, screen resolutions designing for some of the mobile devices out there, you know, As Apple's made such a big deal about the Retina display, the resolution of the screens that we look at, or that we spend some of our time looking at in the case of mobile devices, it's increasing exponentially. It's to the point where, you know, you hold up one of these devices and you look at the screen and you say, I can't see the pixels. Forget about that. In some cases, it might even look better than paper. How does that affect things like font design or the direction that you take when you're considering fonts and typefaces to use?
Oh, I think the density of the screen is really key, and it's wonderful that we're getting to something like 300-line screens pretty soon. Whether those are going to be everywhere and exactly how they'll be used, I can't predict. There's a lot of economics there. There's a certain amount of physics involved. But the thing is that one thing I notice in the on the web, when we went to flat screens, and also on the telephone, the Palm Pre that we worked on, as the density, the resolution increases of these little screens, one of the things you do is you make all the pages smaller. You can get the text it's like the real point size, the actual height to the reader. is much less, but because the resolution has gone down, we can read it. And we just hold the phone slightly closer if we have a problem. And one of the things about readability is that it's like I noticed this in reading Kindle on the iPhone, that you actually want smaller font settings some of the time because you you want to scan a paragraph. You want to read a bunch of text. The way you read is not really letter by letter, and so just the actual size is not as important as clarity, sharpness, edge recognition, and scannability. So if you can get that crammed into something that's like 12 pixels on a high density screen, and you can still read it, then you're doing well. So you know it's like the whole web pages are coming down to the mobile size. I don't think that we're going to solve the screen font problem in the next 5 years. I think that resolution is still going to be a problem that we're going to have to deal with, and people will notice the difference between the designs and the hinting.
It's just fascinating to me the way that things are changing, the speed with which that things are changing. I remember it must have been about 3 or 4 years ago, I was listening to Edward Tufte speak, and he was at the time and probably still complaining a little bit about the screen resolution that we have. He was saying, compare the resolution of our eyes when we look at something. The resolution is amazing. It's unbelievable what we can take in. And then we have to cram everything down into this small little tiny screen. And at the time, there was no iPhone. There was, it was just about to happen when I heard him speak. You know, it's fascinating, though, to me to think of the speed that things are changing. You say 5 years, you know, why 5 years? What will change in that time?
Well, you know, I think we'll have flexible OLED screens pretty quickly. I think that at one level, you know, remember how great it was when we went to flat screens and we didn't have the CRT gun shooting into our eyes? Right. That really was a wonderful improvement. Everything, the shimmer went down, and all of the noise factor went down. It got really better. Still got very bright, you know, white backgrounds, and you know, trying to do the simulated paper on screens still are hard for me. It's too glary for me. But yeah. And I always like black backgrounds. But I'm in a real minority there. But the thing is that if you try to track what's going to happen, I think the number one thing is going to be the universal application of tablets and big smartphones everywhere. But in 5 years, the number of people who have access to some kind of portable mobile internet device is going to be in the Western world something like 75% of the people will have one of these things. Publishers and media folks are going to be giving them away. And they're not going to be all high, you know, big CPUs that are calculating a lot of app stuff. They're really just going to be kind of projector screens that are going to play movies and play readers and other kinds of more passive, more narrative-based web stuff. And they'll surf the web too, but they won't, it's not going to be on the app side so much as I think it's going to be on the website. I at least that's where I'm voting. I think it's all about the web.
So how does the advent and integration of things like e-ink on the Kindle and in other devices play into all this?
I think e-ink is an interim solution. I think it's really great because of the idea that it's reflective, that the battery doesn't run out.
Right.
The new Kindle is a beautiful thing. I don't know if y'all seen it, but it's heard about it today.
Yeah.
It's very lightweight. Very, very small. Fits in your pocket. It's a wonderful thing. But the idea that you're going to have different purpose-built tablets for different things seems a little odd to me. I have an old Kindle and I have an iPad, and I tend to read the Kindle stuff on the iPad or the iPhone now, and not carry them all around. Sure. What I'm curious about, I mean, what I'm thinking about is that we'll probably have a bunch of tablets that are not purpose-built except for as web browsers. That of course, Apple will be pushing the apps. And there are some things, you know, particularly things that are real apps, things that are like use other parts of the platform like geolocation, as opposed to just text or video content. I think that you know a very fancy iPad will be fun for people, but I really think the growth is going to be in all of these Android and fairly low end OS simple $50, $75 tablets around the world, and that's where the web is going to be. It's not going to be fancy apps.
Sell millions of things cheap, not hundreds of thousands of things expensive.
Well, there's always going to be a market, and some people, you know, have Lexuses instead of you know little Toyotas. But
right.
I'm thinking that we could have, we might have a bunch of different tablets. One in the office, one in the car, one that we carry with us, one that stays in the living room. But and some of them will be hooked up as they'll be dependent on the phone. They'll be slaves of that signal, so that you're not paying for another phone line. I actually think that you're going to get that it's through the web we're going to be able to control a lot of things in our environment as we walk around, but the tablets are not going to be as proprietary. They're going to be very universal.
So it's platforms like the web, and then I think what you're also saying is for ubiquity to work, price is a factor, right?
Yeah, clearly.
Which gets us back to, just to finish with WebType, pricing of the fonts. How does that work? It's a hosted service. It's WebType.
Yeah, it's a hosted service. You can self-host if you want to. The price is the same. There is support involved because what we're doing is we're really following the development of the WebType field. And as browsers change, for example, WAF fonts are now going to be an IE. We can change the fonts that are served to each browser OS combination. The prices start about $10 a year for people. You can go up, a big business that wants to buy a font for all of their websites and everything that they're doing, maybe it's a couple of $100 a year, but we're not talking about thousands of dollars. It's not a huge cost. And the reason we like the idea of hosting is that we've got folks, starting with Peter Van Blocklin, who are threading through this thicket of these combinations of browsers, so you can get a really good result. One of the things that flabbergasted me on some of the testing I've done is how well the web type looks on IE using either ClearType or DirectWrite. That's really it's really great, you know. It actually made me think, why? You know, I've been using Macs pretty much since they came out. Why didn't we use EOT fonts before? What were we thinking? That everybody had Macs? They don't. It's one of the strange.
Well, if you go back, Netscape, when Microsoft created EOT, a proprietary font format which to support an open standard, which was at FontFace in CSS 1. Right, CSS 1 says you can embed fonts. Microsoft says, "Great, we'll do that with a proprietary. We'll support that standard with a proprietary font format." Netscape said, "We're not going to support." Remember Netscape? Netscape said, "We're not going to support that standard at all. We have a much better standard that uses JavaScript and a different proprietary, which I think they did with starts with a B
with Bitstream.
With Bitstream, right? So they came up with a different proprietary
TrueDoc,
and I think right there you go." Ask Roger Black. And I think all of us at that point were so freaked out about like the incompatible JavaScript that was already going on with the 3.0 and 4.0 versions of the browser that we just said, you know what, screw embedded fonts. This is ridiculous. We sat it out. And then we forgot that there actually was a standard, right? And that there actually was a font format that we could use to support a non-standard font format that we could use to support that standard. So, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, Netscape wasn't going to do it. Right. And so, right, and all, you know, Mozilla and Opera weren't going to copy Microsoft, so they weren't going to support that proprietary standard. So, yeah, things were just at a. I mean, we've had this standard for like 16 years, and we're just starting to use it now, which is, if you think about.
That's really true. And I think that right now is a wonderful time to be a web designer because it's all blowing up. It's all not all of the conventions and kind of assumptions that we made, many of which we didn't really have to make, but they just everyone kind of fell in line about what a web page is. And we're seeing all kinds of things that are different. And I actually date it to the incursion of video. Once you had things like YouTube taking over, and the data load from on the video side is eclipsing everything else on the web now, it changed the way we look at a page. And once we were free to look at a page differently, we started seeing really different kinds of formatting of web pages, and users are happy to go along. It's they're not, you know, for some kinds of sites like a typical news site, if you're just looking for headlines and facts, you know, a big, you know, the New York Times, the LA Times, USA Today, those kinds of pages are great. But if you want to read the story, the web page hasn't been so great. And so there are a bunch of people, including Philippe Fortes, who I'm working with on TreeSaver, who've been saying, "Hey, we could use the web, make it all web standard, only use HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and get a better result for reading this stuff." And I think that we're seeing. I mean, that's just one of the many kinds of ideas that are happening right now, and it's really exciting.
That's a nice segue to TreeSaver that you provided for yourself. So. Why not tell us a little bit about that the TreeSaver platform and what you're doing, the principles, what you're doing with it, who's interested, all that stuff.
TreeSaver is and I pathetically can't show you this, but I'll give you a URL. If you go to Read Nomad, readnomad.com, you can see TreeSaver, but it's I'm showing it on an iPad
on a YouTube video.
Yeah, there's a video.
Okay,
it is a YouTube video, and it gives you a little a demo of what we're up to, and the idea is that TreeSaver divides content into pages, and it only goes it really. The way we've designed it, it goes in one direction, or it goes left or right. It doesn't go up or down. And so it's not scrolling, it's paged. And one of the cool things about it is that it's able to resize to any screen size. So we can get a really adaptive design that works on an iPhone. And it works on an Android phone or any phone that has a browser, and or anything that has a browser. So you can read stuff. Now, what you just saw is the Nomad Editions is the first customer for TreeSaver. And TreeSaver at Nomad is launching on October 15th. There are four verticals, as they're calling them, four digital weeklies, and each one is designed a little differently because they're about different things. And Nomad, maybe we have time to talk about that in a minute, but it's a different business model than we've seen for websites. It's a subscription model. The advertising is superfluous. And the delightful thing about that is it connects readers and writers directly without advertisers getting in the way. I kind of like that. But the notion of TreeSaver is something that was pretty well due to Philippe Fortes, who is this genius I found at Microsoft when we were doing the New York Times Reader project, which I helped design in the early days. And he came up with the notion of taking that kind of e-reader concept with dynamic layout, which the Microsoft Reader did. That is to say, you could change screen size and the layout adapts to it. He said, "Let's do this in HTML," and it's taken a while to do it. It's very interesting to see that the uptake for it, the people who like the idea of TreeSaver from the publishing side, are all startups. We're finishing Nomad now, and the next launch this fall or early next year is going to be a big news site in Washington, not yet announced, but it's going to be a wholly different use of TreeSaver, but still the main thing to provide what some people call the narrative web, pages you can read, enjoy, sit down with, read on your phone and read them in bed, read them on the airplane, wherever you are. And so using HTML5, we can pretty well do everything that that you see in the apps on things like the iPad.
To me, Philippe, I agree. Philippe is absolutely brilliant, and this idea is brilliant, and the name TreeSaver is just awesome. Congratulations
yeah, love that.
On that.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a stroke, a master stroke. But it's like you've taken something that we might have published on our list apart as an experiment, right? Like a set of constraints and techniques that put together could create a, you know, very fluid, flexible layout that works on any device, and added a couple of, you know, added some additional business rules to account for, you know, basically CMS needs, right? Publishing needs, editorial needs. And you've productized this this experiment, the kind of thing that appeals to geeks, right? Like, you know, the kind of thing that people who read A List Apart, our magazine, love this kind of stuff. You've taken that, you've productized it, and you are interesting, and it is of interest, as you said, to startups. What are the traditional magazines, traditional publishers afraid of it? Are they afraid of a standards-based solution? Are they looking for an iPhone app instead? What exactly... What's their magic bullet? Why aren't they going for this so far?
I think that's a great question, and it's a confounding question. And actually, with the announcement of Nomad, we've had some of the big publishing groups in New York City contact us, and we're talking to them. And we were just over at they're all around Sixth Avenue. We have several meetings on Sixth Avenue, and then one over on Eighth Avenue this month. But the thing is that. You know, there's a lot of problems. It has to do with the stakeholders. Anybody who's designed a website knows what it's like when you get in a room and there's 15 people who all want the different things on the homepage or on the, they have different goals for the site. And I think that that's true in the big magazine and newspaper groups where there is some division between editorial and advertising. There is a problem with the current business model for all of the publishing business. The advertising, what I call the CPM model, the cost per thousand ad rates, is no longer working. It's not supporting these folks. And they have to either cut and ruin the product or find a new business model. And so they're distracted, and your comment that is it proprietary or non-open that they like? Well, that's what they're used to. I mean, we've been talking about this since the late 80s. I remember Jonathan Siebold, who was a great production clairvoyant in the early days of desktop publishing, said standard platforms shrink wrap software. That was what he was pushing in 1986 or something. And it's still hard for these guys to realize that, you know, that what's essentially open source, TreeSaver is going to go open source. The notion of all of the stuff we're working with is open source so that a whole community can develop to it as opposed to, you know, buying the box and telephone number that you call if it doesn't work. And I'm thinking that, you know, so production, technology, IT folks, there are all of these constituencies in these big companies, and it's very hard to get them aligned. There's another thing that's more philosophical, which is they're so used to their culture, the way that they do things, their lifestyle, that it's hard for them to move that. You know, it's hard for them to change, even though they know they have to change. They still think it's a magazine. You see apps, and I don't want to put anybody down because I actually enjoyed the Wired app or the Popular Science app or the Popular Mechanics app or even Time magazines. Those are all kind of gussied up magazines. They're all magazines that have had video bolted onto them and maybe some buttons that you have to reach up for so that you are interactive and it's more game-like and more fun. But they're still magazines, and I don't think that the way to succeed in this new multi-platform arena is to push your magazine in through this internet tube and, you know, put some features on it and hope for the best, particularly if you're just doing to one platform. I mean, look at all the work that some of these folks have done to make an iPad app. And right. If you talk to them, it's like, oh, high five, we're done, everything's great, we have an iPad app. Well, hell, there's only, you know, 5 million iPads in the world. How many of your market, how many people actually have one and will pay any attention once they've downloaded the app? I mean, We can use the ubiquity of the web to push things out to wherever people want them, as opposed to refashioning one product for one system. And I think that we can't think about it as just a magazine that's on the web. That's wrong. We have to get much more basic. And I think what's cool about Nomad is that they're saying, let's reinvent the connection between readers and writers. That can be really interactive. It can be really compelling. It's not all passive. You can comment right back at him. The discussion can begin with that, but it can be very personal and intimate. And that's some of the stuff that's been missing on the web outside of social media. Let's put it in the old fashioned media and just distribute it using all this new stuff.
I wish I had a highlighter pen for audio, because I would definitely highlight the last 10 minutes of what you've been saying. That's really fantastic stuff. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, there's more stuff here that I've been thinking about. I mean, you asked me before we went on that, is this all related? All these things related? What are you doing? And I guess they are. The last 2 years, I've been kind of fallow in the sense of just waiting for the rain, waiting for more seed. The media business was pretty much coming apart at the seams. Last year I had one giant engagement, which Jeffrey helped on, which was the Washington Post redesign. And it was very interesting, and you could see close hand some of the issues and problems that those guys were facing. But I, there in the media side of the web and in the media in general, there wasn't much activity in the last couple of years. The economy was kicked in the head. The whole mood was not hopeful or expectant. And through that, I had enough time to just think. And most of the things that we're doing here are trying to address what I noticed was missing. And it turns out I wasn't the only one. I mean, I have a fairly minor role in each of these endeavors. Philippe's pushing the tree saver thing. Rob Rice and Sam Berlow and Eduardo Danilo are much more active in Ready Media. The Font Bureau and Ascender folks, and we got Nick Sherman to come in at the Font Bureau to help with WebType. There's great work being done there. And Peter Van Blocklin has been creating this new CMS, that's WYSIWYG, that's going to be applied to Nomad called Sherpa, which is unbelievably fantastic. And these things begin to start gluing together because we're using them on the same products. But they're really separate needs. And it's interesting to see what could happen with the ecosystem. If you start making a web design that is itself driven by algorithm as opposed to page layout, it starts getting kind of interesting. And ultimately, you ask yourself, so what direction are we going in? I've always tried to figure out where are they going. That's one reason I was successful in the 90s. I figured out first that desktop publishing was in the 80s was going to be the next thing, and then you didn't have to be that bright to realize the web was going to be a big deal in 1995. Right. It was one of the most exciting things that's happened. So the thing is that but where are we going? What's the ultimate direction of things? And it's clearly to me, web design, when you have dynamic websites, you have templates. So web design is really template design. You're making containers that changing content is flowing through. That to me is really interesting. And to me, that's the most fun part of design. Figuring out what are the rules that makes that work is really the big challenge of web design. And people with CSS started figuring out, okay, we can apply different widths and make things work on mobile, or we can adapt to changing screen sizes. With Tree Saver, we can adapt very, very literally to different screen size. It gets now that kind of makes it much harder to design the templates. Right. But once you get through the logic, it's the best way to do it. It's fantastic. You get so much more throughput. And ultimately, if we can attach tools to that design process, which is the thing that's missing, it's still all you know, a great deal of hand coding. If we can figure out how to automate that piece, then the direction will go really fast. It will be fantastic.
There'll be more adoption because all the tools are there. People don't have to figure it out from scratch like they do now. So Peter Van Blocklin's designing Sherpa, which is a CMS for this more fluid kind of layout. I think of it sort of like when you use an EPUB and you look at the same EPUB on a phone and on an iPad, the pagination's different because the page sizes are different, but the table of contents still works and you can still click the links and go to the chapters. I mean, it's just like those kinds of problems writ large, yeah. Right? It's
well, all
the
complexity what he's doing,
of the website, but
you should get Peter on this show. He is a genius. And the idea, what he's doing in the CMS field is moving the actual targets out of the picture and focusing on the components of the content, the media assets, and then so that allows, if you have a malleable enough control panel on the CMS, you can then start saying, okay, I got video, I got text, I have various other things. Where do I put them? How do I edit them? How do I push them together to make the most effective podcast, slideshow, and in fact, what Peter's saying, we could go back to print. We could actually take the same thing and print it out, and you run it back through InDesign. And that's that kind of multi-directional, multi-platform approach to CMS is what we've been looking for. Because almost everything, you know, Drupal is wonderful, Django is wonderful, but they don't do print. They don't. They can't do all the stuff that we might be doing in these operations. So, I think, you know, and ultimately in the long run, if you get these. You get the software to control design, the designer can actually step away from being the boss. The designer can let the user be the boss and let the controls go on the other side of the spectrum. And that's what the web is all about too. The idea that, okay, it's not necessarily about control, it's about making things happen for people. And let's make these, if you can assemble these tools in a fluid enough way, then ultimately I think that that we can see the direction going from the kind of one-to-many publishing of the past to real one-to-one, where there's real communication and the reader or user ultimately gets to say what's happening.
Wow. Well, Roger, I'm going to need some Thorazine to come down from this interview. It's mind-blowing, as always. The opportunity to chat with you is always a great joy and eye-opener, and we're really
grateful. We were going to change places. Do they know we're in the same place?
We are not only in the same building, we're in the same floor. In fact, we're in the same suite of offices. So, yeah, we were going to actually swap chairs, and then Dan, when he swapped, Dan would go like, "What?" And the viewers would go, like,
"Yeah, he's back."
But instead of the Jerry Lewis angle, we just got so caught up in the actual ideas.
Who knew communications could be so entertaining? You know. But, well, Roger, thank you very much for being our guest today. It was a great pleasure to have you. Thanks, Jeffrey, always for co-hosting and That about does it for today's episode. So thanks to all of you for tuning in. We'll see you all again next week.
Bye-bye.
All right, have a great day.
Thanks again to our guest today, Roger Black. You can visit rogerblack.com and webtype.com to learn more. Thanks to MailChimp for making this show possible. You can visit them at MailChimp.com/5x5 for special deals just for you guys. And of course, thanks to you for listening. You can hear previous episodes of this show and check out all of the shows that we produce by visiting 5x5.tv. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating the show on iTunes. It's the single best way to help new listeners find out about the show. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.